From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're continuing our coverage of the fortunes of the Salt Lake Tribune. The editor, Jennifer Napier Pierce, has agreed to join us today. It's been a rough couple of weeks for her, but it's important to ask not only about the health of the paper, but what happened in the first place. We should also mention the Ogden Standard Examiner has been experiencing difficulties. They've had layoffs this month as well, so we'll talk about that and how the crisis in journalism is decimating newsrooms, but also leading to real innovation after this.
On the next More to Say, it's no secret that rent around Salt Lake is really high. Take a drive downtown and you'll see tons of new apartments under construction, but most Utahns can't afford them. Not according to the common definition of affordable housing, 30% of your income. There's a staggering need for cheaper apartments around the state, but hardly any incentives to build them. Because those pricey places, they're not sitting empty. KUER's Whitney Evans has been looking into this. She'll be on the next More to Say, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Last week, 34 people at the Salt Lake Tribune were informed they had lost their jobs, reporters, editors, photographers, other staff members. And it's been a brutal month for Utah journalism in general. The Ogden Standard Examiner also had to lay off 21 people this month, five of them in the newsroom, as they try to adjust to what seems to be a new reality for newspapers all over the country. Utah native Rhett Long has been publisher of the Daily Herald for nearly a year. He's now taking on that same role for the Standard Examiner. We invited him to join us on the program today. He was not available. And the fact is, this is happening all over the state. The Provo Daily Herald had layoffs a few years ago, and weekly papers in American Fork, Lehigh, Pleasant Grove, Orem, Springville, Spanish Fork, all closed in the last 10 years or so. In preparation for last week's show, we talked to a few of the reporters at the Tribune who had just lost their jobs, and while they felt gutted for themselves, of course, more than a few expressed sympathy for the managers at the Tribune who felt like they had no choice but to make the cuts. One reporter said to us that it must have been one of the most difficult days in Jennifer Napier Pierce's life. Jennifer is the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, a role she took on in 2016. When Paul Huntsman bought the paper. Before that, she was a business writer, host of the paper's daily video program. She's been a reporter and a news director here at KUER, of course. She's joining us on the program to talk about what's happening at the Tribune and how she's seeing the way forward for the paper. And Jennifer Napier Pierce, welcome to you. Thanks very much for doing this.
Thanks. I wish we were meeting under better circumstances.
Yeah, I do too. So I guess I wanted to begin with that quote that I think it was kind of a powerful quote by someone who said, this has got to be the worst day of Jennifer's life. Or one of them anyway, was it?
I totally appreciate the sentiment. And yes, it's brutal. I would never wish this on anyone else, any other managers out there. But honestly, my thoughts are with the people who are directly affected. I mean, it's not about me. It's about them and about the fate of the newspaper in general.
Yeah. I'm not sure how much you can feel like you can share about the particulars of the decision. I'm going to prod you as much as I can. Can you take me through the days leading up to when you made the decision itself? Like, not the day that you had to break the news necessarily, but the days when you decided the only thing we can do is another round of layoffs. Like, what was going on?
Well, this stretches back months. And my managers and my team all know this. We started to go through a budget process at the end of last year, and it was a directive from Paul that we needed to trim back. We needed to cut some expenses. And I did everything that I could, scaling back travel and overtime and all of the low-hanging fruit. And then gosh, time is fluid right now. I guess it's been about a month. Paul had a conversation with me and said that we needed more significant cuts, that the bleeding was getting to the point where it was not sustainable. And so that started a whole lot of evaluation and how far can we go and still function as a newspaper, not as a news organization, but as a paper? How do you get out a physical paper every single day? I mean, that takes a lot of heavy lifting. So, yeah, I mean, none of these are easy. None of these were for cause. All of these were excruciating. Yeah. It's just a brutal process. And it's not like a company like, I don't want to put Bank of America on the spot, that has hundreds of thousands of employees. I mean, these are close employees that I see every day. So that made it extra difficult.
Yeah. Why did Paul Huntsman buy this paper?
He says he's committed to this institution as a community asset. He says that Utah cannot function as a society without an independent voice. He saw that the Tribune was on the brink of disaster. Not just disaster, on the brink of elimination. And so...
is that true?
That was true.
Yeah.
That is true. Previous to Paul's ownership, Alden Global Capital, which is a hedge fund based in New York, owned the paper. And we've seen this cycle play out at newspapers across the country that they've owned. They cut, they slash, they're still making profits, but they continue to pare back and pare back till a newspaper is just a shell of itself. And that was the plan for the Salt Lake Tribune.
How is Paul Huntsman, though, in purchasing the paper different from that? Because I think what people are seeing is, well, he bought it, but then pared it back and pared it back. And I guess the essential question is, did he think of it and does he think of it as a business venture, you know, or as a way of shoring up this valuable community asset, this valuable community institution? I mean, they've got plenty of money. Why does he care that you're bleeding a little bit of it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand the sentiment. I can't remember who said it, but somebody out there said the easiest thing to do is to spend somebody else's money. In my ideal world, of course, Paul Huntsman was just going to fund this venture in perpetuity without regard to the losses. He did. He's floated us for almost 2 years to the day. He's invested significantly in the paper, so I take nothing away from that. He owns other businesses. He has told me many times that the Tribune is just different. It's different from his other businesses. He does not expect us to make a profit. If we do get lucky enough to make a profit, he's going to pour those resources back into the newsroom. I take him at his word.
But he could only stand so many losses. Is that the way he thought about it too?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for Paul.
Okay.
I can't spend his money, unfortunately. I do think that he's been very generous, but he does consider this to be a community asset. So if this is truly a community institution, why should one family support it alone?
Yeah.
Why should not the community be expected to step up at some point?
One of the questions that has come up, and it came up on our program last week, was whether or not Paul Huntsman and the management team at the Tribune had been patient enough. That, look, he's had it for a couple of years now, and he's been generous enough to float you, as you put it, for a while. But if you look at what Bezos is doing with the Post and what's happening at the Boston Globe, where you have these wealthy philanthropists who also feel strongly about shoring up those institutions, they're just a little bit more patient, that they realize it's going to take more than a couple of years, that yes, you're going to have losses, but that, and this is not just Paul Huntsman, but also to the management team. So I know you can't speak for him, but it seems like you can speak for the management team. You guys just weren't patient enough. You should have let this play out a little bit longer. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't know how, as a manager, I could tell the owner, no. you must change your course. I made significant arguments, and I felt like they were the best arguments that I could make. At the end of the day, this was Paul Huntsman's decision, and I respect him as an investor. I respect him as somebody who truly is interested in the well-being of the community and understands journalism's role in that well-being. So, you know, I can't answer for him.
Yeah.
You'll have to have him on the show at another time.
We're trying.
I mean, as far as patience goes, look, is 5 years enough? I mean, what's the magic number, really?
I don't think anyone knows what the magic number is.
I don't think anybody knows either.
Yeah.
And the Bezos equation is an outlier.
In what way?
He owns Amazon.
Yeah. Okay. I guess the reason
it's a national institution. It has scale behind it.
Yeah.
So Trump has been very good for their business. That's their company town. Politics is their bread and butter. And small local regional newspapers like the Salt Lake Tribune, it's a much harder road.
Maybe then put to bed this idea that Paul Huntsman was thought of as the Bezos of the Salt Lake Tribune, that he had unlimited funds that he could access to shore up this institution. Are you saying that, and I'm not, again, I know you can't speak for him, that it's not the same thing? I mean, that's essentially what you said. He has Amazon, but Huntsman also has access to a lot of resources.
Yeah, they absolutely do. I mean, so in a lot of ways, we've taken the Bezos model, we've incorporated it at the Salt Lake Tribune. We have retargeted exactly how we define news. We've built our new website based on their digital tools. We have a close association with them, but it's a completely different animal in terms of scale and in terms of resources. I'm not saying that Paul Huntsman is by any means poor, but I do think that this is a personal venture. This is not a family venture, and it's not a charity either. It's a business.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that when you start looking at the significant losses that he was looking at and paying for every single month, it's a hard thing not to say we need to scale back.
Yeah. One of the Tribune's articles on the layoffs and the cutbacks, it cited a 40% decline in ad revenue and a plummeting, that's the word that was used, plummeting circulation, somewhere around a 36% loss.
I will correct you.
Will you?
Our ad revenue is actually down 30%. It's still steep. It's still more than the national trends that we're seeing. That's 30% since 2016.
Well, that was the thing that actually came up in our conversation last week on the show. We had a media analyst who follows the business of papers. His name is Ken Doctor. And he said that number, those numbers are the highest he's heard of in the country. So I wonder what you think accounts for that. Why it would be not only different, but drastically different from numbers in other parts of the country. Have you thought about what might account for that?
Well, again, I don't think it's drastically different.
You don't?
No. I'm mixing up my studies, but I think it was a Poynter Institute study, or maybe it was Pew, that did cite a 40% decline over the past decade. So for us to see 15% on average a year over the last 2 years, that's pretty steep. That is steep.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's unusual for the marketplace. It is our circulation is down as well. And when you have that sort of 1-2 punch, it's hard to recover from.
Yeah.
Print is just a unique animal. We think of a lot of journalism out there as just being produced, and I don't think that people realize the labor that's involved, the cost of newsprint, the distribution and circulation models that are out there. It's a physical product that has to be delivered onto doorsteps every single morning. And so there's a lot of costs that are involved in that. And those are costs that can't go away,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how many you're producing. It really is. Those costs of distribution don't go away if you want to have a paper.
Back to those numbers just for a moment, I wanted to ask you, one of the things Ken Doctor has wondered is what the joint operating agreement may have to do with those numbers if in some way you still haven't quite figured out an equal split or what's your relationship with the Deseret Morning, Deseret News, and how that might be playing into those numbers that might make them distinctive. Can you respond to that?
Well, the JOA is just a weird thing, right? I mean, there are only five news organizations that have JOAs in the country now. And so the Salt Lake Tribune and the Deseret News have this contractual obligation to one another. We want each other to succeed because we're tied at the hip financially. The JOA is in effect until December 31 of 2020. And we'll see what happens after that. But I can tell you that JOAs across the country, the five that are remaining, they've stripped down their print production. They are only printing, you know, Thursday, Friday, Sunday editions. They are combining, like we see in Las Vegas, where the Las Vegas Sun is basically an insert into the Review Journal. They're trying to be as creative as possible while still producing a print product that they can be proud of and the consumers want. So, you know, it's a difficult situation, I think, when you have a partner that you are not in full control of, where the profit split is not equal. And, you know, the Salt Lake Tribune's, ironically, our circulation is bigger than our partners. And so when you're getting fewer of those profits, it makes it a difficult situation for sure. I mean, we're going to start renegotiating with them as we march toward the end of our current term, and we'll see what happens.
I wanted to ask you about how committed you feel to that tactile piece of paper, that newsprint. Is it in the equation at all that you just say, look, let's forego the print stuff, the actual paper stuff, and we'll just print we'll just put together a digital version of this news organization? I mean, how committed are you to the idea of somebody throwing a paper on someone's porch?
We're as committed as long as there are consumers to buy it. So at some point, there will be a point of diminishing returns. Yeah. I think that there always will be some sort of print version of the Salt Lake Tribune. It may be more of a niche product. It may cost a lot more. I don't see it going away wholesale, and particularly not before the JOA expires. I mean, that's just not in the cards. We still have a very healthy subscriber base, and we want to meet their needs, and we respect them as consumers. I love the paper, so I am not looking for any avenues that will hasten its demise. But, you know, at some point, reality may kick in, and we'll have to see. I mean, there have been plenty of publications go digital only. It has its own issues because I think a lot of people are not used to paying for digital content, and it requires significant investment, even in digital, because journalism is very labor intensive. It's about people and reporters going out there and digging through documents and fighting for access. And that's not cheap, right?
What did you learn about that, about the willingness of people to pay for digital content when you instituted the paywall a couple of months ago?
Yeah, launched February 1, surprisingly healthy. And I do think people's attitudes are changing a little bit. I mean, we live, you know, 5 years ago, how many people were paying for Spotify and Hulu and Netflix and all of those subscription-based products? Not as many as today. And so I think especially for the younger generation, they just sort of see this as natural. Now, there is a cap. How much are you going to pay? Are you going to pay for Slate? You know, what do you value? And at some point, consumers are going to have to assess how local news fits into that mix. The Tribune, of course, is the first one in this market to experiment. We've had a very healthy response so far. I hope it continues because it's our future. We need to have a healthy dose of digital income coming our way to keep sustaining our newsroom.
You scored a success so far.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. About 65% of newspapers nationally have a paywall. So we're not at the tip of the spear on this one. You know, we're sort of learning from other people's experiences. And I will say that this community has responded very well to the ask. They get it. I think it's quite unfortunate that this bad news comes at the same time as some good news on the digital front. But
well, a lot of people are connecting those two. Like, oh, they put up this paywall, 3 months later, they're dead.
We're not dead. we still have one of the largest newsrooms in the state. We still have a Pulitzer Prize winning team. We still have the best sports writers at a local newspaper in the country. I mean, we just have a stack of awards for our watchdog journalism, our accountability reporting. So we're definitely far from dead. This cut hurts, though. I'm not going to lie.
But I guess the question, sorry, that I was trying to ask was it related at all to the paywall? I mean, there's
because
you hear all these comments that paywall really hurt them. You're saying, in fact, no.
No. You know, we saw a few weeks where people were testing the waters and our traffic definitely dipped. But our audience is there. Our audience is healthy. And we have many more millions of readers in the digital realm than we have subscribers of the paper. So really, I mean, when I talk about shifting to a future, digital is the future. And print is an important part of our legacy, but it can't be our future because that's not where consumers are.
What took so long for you guys to fix your website?
Investment.
Yeah.
Three words, Alden Global Capital. I mean,
is that right?
Yeah, really. I think that...
So you hear that sense of frustration about the website from people, right, beforehand?
Oh, yeah, yes, yeah. Yes. Before we fixed the website, it was just... It was a mess. It was difficult to navigate. Didn't really think about a reader's experience on how they want to use news. That was one of my first priorities when I became editor, is to make this something that was usable, it was functional, it was fast. And again, our partnership with the Washington Post has really helped in that regard.
I wanted to ask you about one of the arguments that we've heard in response to the Tribune is that one of the questions, I guess I should put it that way, is that, like, if you look at, for example, what happened with the Deseret News, this was an argument that was made in an email last week. When they made their cut, they had a brutal cut in 2010,
yeah,
some 47% of the paper. And so they had to recraft the vision forward for the paper. And they did a bunch of things. I think some that were obvious, maybe some that weren't so much. Obviously, they altered the focus of the paper to be even more focused on LDS members, basically.
Faith and family.
Faith and family, exactly. That personifies right there the focus. What about the Tribune? What kind of alteration did you figure you had to make to the focus of the paper? Did you have a similar kind of grand vision that you had to rework a bit?
Yes and no. I mean, we're continuing on a path that we have a strong tradition of investigative reporting and watchdog reporting. That will not change. That absolutely will not change. The realities, though, are that we cannot be at every city council meeting. We cannot physically be at every school board meeting. And so we are ever more reliant on good, reliable sources giving us tips and letting us know there's something amiss here, and then we'll check into it. And fortunately, the community has responded in spades. We get a lot of good tips, and we follow up on a lot of them. And, you know, we don't have capacity for everything, but we're doing the best that we can. So that focus will absolutely remain for as long as I'm at the paper. That's not going away. One thing that we...
Did you change your faith section? Like, did you see as a way of, that gets a lot of clicks, stories about Mormonism and those kinds,
sure,
of things. We're going to alter our faith section to maybe cover visits of Mormon general authorities maybe more in a way that we hadn't in the past. Or I've heard some comments about that. I wanted to get you to give you a chance to respond to that.
I don't see it. I see that our faith reporters are as aggressive as they ever have been. I mean, again, the Tribune's legacy is to be a check and a balance on institutions of power. And the most powerful institution in the state of Utah, love it or not, is the LDS Church. And so we're going to report aggressively on policies, how those affect individuals, Mormon finances, on social change within the church. There's a lot of demographic shifting going on right now. So anything that the Tribune can do to shed a light on how that institution uses its power, both politically and socially, we're very, very interested in. And that's not going to change either. Our sports coverage, like I mentioned, is excellent and strong and has a dedicated reader base. So we're not going to give that up. But on the edges, I mean, we are trying to figure out a way to continue to cover arts, to continue to cover business. It's difficult, you know, and you have to make strategic choices. I think on the whole, though, our focus remains on excellent storytelling and on accountability journalism.
Amy Donaldson of the Deseret News says she's been feeling really emotional about all of this. We get so many emails from journalists about this. And she also says she feels defensive of her Tribune colleagues and, you know, I'm sure sympathetic about all of this. But one of the things she said, just as a way of critique, is the way this is being framed, I think, from her view. She writes this, I find the subscribe or democracy will die mantra infuriating. How is guilt-tripping, liberty-loving citizens into paying for a paper that they won't read and is still delivered by 12-year-olds any different from asking us to support coal because generations of family have made their living that way and they deserve to continue doing so? Amy says, I don't see a difference really there. How do you respond to that idea that you can't guilt trip people into paying for this thing? They have to want to pay for this thing.
Well, for sure. I don't see informing the public on what it takes to watchdog our institutions of power as a guilt trip. I mean, I really don't. I think it's okay to ask people to make a connection between reliable sources of news and a functioning democracy. I think that's a perfectly legitimate connection for people to know. I mean, because I think people think news just comes out of the ether. Well, the fact is, you know, we're still involved in lawsuits on our Pulitzer Prize winning coverage. Large newspaper organizations are the only ones who can undertake that kind of expense. It's very costly. When you have legions of reporters out there, it costs money.
Yeah.
So if you want reliable sources of information to help you as a citizen, I just don't see that as a guilt trip. I really don't.
I guess the question is, can news survive as a business? Can it survive in certainly in this current incarnation? What do you think?
Well, the jury is out, right? I think local ownership has a greater chance of success than the detached hedge fund model. That's certainly not working. There hasn't been a lot of success when it comes to a nonprofit model for legacy newspapers. I only know of one, really, that and the jury is still out for them. It's the Philadelphia Inquirer, and their owner set up a $20 million endowment to help them a couple of years ago transition from a for-profit business to a nonprofit. But again, they have all of the trappings of a newspaper. That paper is expensive. It's labor intensive to produce and to distribute. Those industry factors don't go away just because you're a nonprofit, right? Yeah. So yeah. We'll see if they can make a go of it as a business. The Tampa Bay Times, which is run or owned by the Poynter Institute, they're a nonprofit, but they are still subject to the same market forces that we are. It doesn't insulate them as an organization, and they've had cutbacks too. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what the right equation is going to be. All I know is that newspapers right now, the industry is suffering and it's difficult. And it's important, though. I mean, that's why I'm still here. It's important.
Was there any equivocation at all by the Huntsman's, for example, about this question of whether to run it as a business or run it as a nonprofit? And do you think there could be some reevaluation down the line where, even though, as you say, the market forces are still there and still real, that there might be some difference in treating it as a nonprofit rather than a business?
Well, yeah, but that's where the JOA kind of presents a wrinkle. So, yes, Paul is exploring all options, including a nonprofit model. But we are tied in a contractual agreement with another for-profit business. So that makes it a little bit tricky.
There's not much you can do about the speculation surrounding whether this was Paul Huntsman's project or whether it was John Huntsman Sr.'s project, that it was something that he sort of assigned to his son or bestowed on his son. But there are some questions about whether this would have happened, these latest round of layoffs, if John Huntsman Sr. had still been alive. How are you responding to that question?
There is absolutely no question that John Huntsman Sr. was our chief advocate. He was a cheerleader for us from the very beginning. He wanted this to be part of his family's legacy. He wanted the Tribune to be part of the Huntsman brand. Paul labored for 2 years. I have no doubt that he is personally invested, that he's emotionally invested in sustaining the resource. Is the commitment, I mean, does it end with the father dying?
That's the question.
I don't think so. I mean, I really don't.
If the
easy answer for Paul is to sell the assets of the paper and close up shop. I mean, that's what a practical business person would do, because we're not making money. We're losing lots of money. So
that's exactly right.
Right.
So you don't know the answer to that. You don't know.
No.
Oh, you do.
He would have done it already.
I see.
I mean, whether or not his father had lived, I think he would have just said, you know, let's cut our losses and go along our merry way. He really is interested in keeping the Tribune brand strong and central to the state. He truly believes in Utah's independent voice.
I wonder, cutting people from the paper makes it even more difficult. If that doesn't just make it more complicated in trying to... Surely, was this a case you were making to Paul Huntsman?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, my job is to make sure that we have every advantage. But again, I mean, it's not my wallet. I can make every argument that I want. I can spend his money for as long as he'll give it to me. But at the end of the day, you know, I don't have to make that calculus. I can make the best arguments. I can say why a larger news staff meets our mission goals. And, you know.
Hopefully it works.
Yeah.
What do readers want? When you look at, one of the things that Ellen Fagg-Wiest said on the show was that some of the, and I'm sure you get this idea that, look, some of the arts pieces weren't getting the clicks. And so how much are you driven by that, by paying attention to the, you know, the metrics on the digital online, and how much is that driving? And then how much do you balance what people want versus what you're hearing from your reporters is what they need, I guess, if I could put it that way.
Look, I think that people say clicks, but clicks are people. So clicks are audience. And so, you know, when you are saying, well, this is too data driven, I think it would be ignorant and naive for us not to even put metrics into the mix of analysis. Does that drive our news values? No, it doesn't. Does it influence? Yeah. Does it inform us? Yes. Does it tell us what kinds of stories people are interested in? Yes. How can we make the vegetables of news, you know, the stuff that is truly meaty and we need to be delivering this? How do we make that more interesting, how more palatable to our audience? So those are all things that are at the forefront of my thinking right now.
Yeah.
You know, Ellen did tremendous reporting, and everybody who was part of this layoff, I mourn for them, because they're amazing reporters, all of them. But at some point, you have to say, can we scale back to a point where it's still a product that people want to buy, that people need? We will still continue to do some arts coverage, but it's going to be different. It has to be.
Yeah.
I can't afford to spend my tiny little resources on things that no one's going to read. I mean, it's kind of like the tree falling in the forest, right?
Let me ask you this finally. As you're, I know you're still putting all of this together. As you're thinking of the things, the stories that you might be wanting to pursue that you can, given the limited resources you have now, does that mean what? Does that mean longer form pieces like Matt Canham's recent series, which is really terrific, or things like that? Are you thinking of more? Because we're going to shift gears here in a moment with our next guest to talk about the creative things that newsrooms are doing. How are you thinking about that creativity and innovation, this opportunity that's sort of sadly presented itself to you?
One of the things that we've blatantly stolen from the Washington Post playbook is getting rid of the incremental, low-impact stories. I went to the city council meeting, and this is what happened. Instead of focusing on what it means, giving context, giving a storyline that people want to hear, how does this affect their lives? So I'm encouraging my reporters to still go to these meetings, to still listen in on committee hearings, but not to feel obligated to do a story just because they have to do a story. I want them to do reporting that is meaningful, that has impact, that has scale, that affects a lot of people versus the tiny 10 gadflies that are attending anything, that have more universal themes. So in that way, I'm challenging our reporters to just think a little bit differently about how they're spending their time. There are fewer of us, so they could work around the clock if I asked them to. I just am asking them to reevaluate priorities and think about what this community really needs to hear.
Jennifer Napier-Pierce, she's editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. I really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks very much. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been continuing our coverage about the layoffs at the Salt Lake Tribune. I should also mention that the Ogden Standard Examiner had layoffs that also happened this month. 21 people lost their jobs, I think 5 in the newsroom. And it underscores that this is happening all over the state, in fact, all over the country. Joining us now on the program is Kristen Hare, who is a reporter with the Poynter Institute. It's a nonprofit school for journalism. Hare focuses on the transformation of local news, and she's joining us from the studios of Poynter in St. Petersburg, Florida. And Kristen Hare, thank you very much for being with us. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when you hear these really difficult conversations like that you heard between me and Jennifer Napier-Pierce, what are you hearing when you hear editors trying to explain what happened and how they see the way forward? Just give me your general reaction to what you've heard so far.
You know, my first reaction was really a lot of admiration for Jennifer for coming on and taking your questions. It shouldn't be surprising that journalists and editors are being transparent about what we're dealing with. But, you know, as somebody who has to cover these things on a regular basis, it's sometimes hard to get them to comment. And to get her to come and sit with you for 40 minutes and answer tough questions, I admire the fact that she did it. I also heard a lot of similarities with what I've seen over the last several years around the country. Most newsrooms, newspaper newsrooms, are a third to a quarter of the size that they once were. Yeah. We are starting to see, you know, some patches of success in lots of different ways, but, you know, it's about the business, it's about the business, it's about the business. And there is a desire, I think, and you talked about this, there's a desire to sort of democracy or die. You know, we have to have this. This is essential. And that's going to appeal to a portion of the audience, but that is not going to save a business.
Yeah, it seems like the people who agree with that idea democracy needs the fourth estate. They need a free press. They're already paying for it, right?
Right. So the American Press Institute did a study earlier this year about what leads people to become subscribers. And they found 9 different paths. And the democracy path was one, and maybe 22-24% of people were on that path. People become subscribers. People pay for news for lots of reasons, including because they think it's useful. They want to know what's happening locally. Their friends and family know what's happening locally. They're new to a place, and they want to get to know it better. And so this drumbeat, and I think it's an important drumbeat, don't get me wrong, of this is essential for our democracy. It's great, but it's missing lots of people who would pay for the news for a lot of other reasons.
I want to ask you about that. Let's talk about some of those other reasons. What are the opportunities that newspapers are missing in that way? Talk a little bit about some of those things.
Well, you know, I think anybody who has tried to subscribe, unsubscribe, contact a staff member, I mean, the biggest opportunity that most newspapers are missing is really in their technology. Mm-hmm. And it's a struggle everywhere. You know, if you are, you guys have been talking about the Washington Post and the New York Times. If you're someone who reads either of those products digitally, you know that it is a pretty easy and seamless experience. And especially on your phone, it is very easy to read that. And sadly, most local news products aren't like that. And so you're asking someone to pay for information, but we have this audience that is so savvy because our user experience and technology is so sophisticated that we're not able to deliver that. So who wants to pay for that? You know, it's understandable. I think newspapers are also, you know, missing the opportunity. Everyone's been swept up in this wave of virality and how do we do the story that everybody else has that's doing really well. And what we're finding, and I spent some time earlier this year in Seattle at Seattle Times, and they decided to add. So we are looking at data. We're looking at how many people are clicking, right? Yep. Jennifer said those are people.
Yep.
Who's coming? How long are they staying? Where else are they going? How often did they come back? Those are all really important numbers. But in Seattle, the Times added a metric onto their list of metrics that shows who's subscribing after reading my story. And so they have found a way to connect the journalism to the impact that it has on the business. And the amazing thing is that what they found was that the stories that people were subscribing to were the kinds of stories that journalists want to do and that I think people want from journalists. They were watchdog. They were adding context locally. They were in-depth. They weren't the kind of things that you maybe see on Facebook and think, who is this even from?
Right.
They were the things that really only good local journalists can do.
Well, that is great, right? I mean, I have to say that seems reassuring that, in fact, when it comes right down to it, you can find a group. It's not, they don't just want crummy cat videos. They really are engaged. And what that says to me is that there is potential to get these audiences, that they're out there. The trick is getting it the right way, right?
So, exactly. And I think newspapers have been, you know, embarrassingly behind on digital for a number of reasons. Jennifer mentioned, you know, who you're owned by. I also think, I think I'm someone in kind of a bridge generation. I spent the first 5 years of my career at a newspaper, the next 5 at an online only, and I've been at Pointer for 5 years. And I truly think that the idea in the beginning, I remember at my first newspaper, I was one of the youngest, and I was put on a young readers committee, and the idea was, how do we get young people to read newspapers? Yeah. I don't hear those discussions anymore. Now it's, what do we need to do to be in the places where our audiences are? Mm-hmm. But it took too long, I think, for newsrooms to get there.
So these are the two things that you said are critical mm-hmm. to success. So we've talked about technology and
right.
then that audience component part. What is, say a little bit more about the audience part of the equation.
I think the audience part of the equation is sort of the biggest.
Yeah.
And what I've seen, and Jennifer talked about this, and what I've seen around the country is as newsrooms are starting to change and they're transforming in many cases the slowest way possible. You may need to like put it on, you know, Hyperloop to actually see it happening. But they're doing a series of things that are allowing them to make decisions with much smaller staff significantly smaller staff. So they've started, one of the things is that, you know, they recognize that their audience is online. And so I don't know about you, Doug, but when I wake up in the morning, I open my phone and I do the crossword puzzle and I read the newspaper, and you know, that's where I'm getting my news.
Yeah.
A lot of newspapers are built toward this evening deadline, and so they're not updating their websites until 10, 11. So what I like to tell people is, you know, we sent small children out into the dark of night so that people had a newspaper waiting on their doorstep first thing in the morning. Why would you not have a team ready at 6 a.m. pushing news as people are waking up? So they're doing that. They're making decisions about what they're going to stop doing. Jennifer mentioned maybe stop covering those, you know, the meetings where nothing happens. You still have people there, but you're not covering them. They're redefining their beats. And so a lot of newspapers have stopped, they've stopped covering institutions and they've started covering people and phenomena. Mm. So for instance, there's a taxpayer beat. If you're going to write about transportation, maybe you're on the commuter beat. You're thinking differently. You're writing about maybe fans if you write about sports or players and their lives. My beat, the transformation of local news, is very much something, it's a phenomenon, right? It's not something that will probably always exist. And then I think the last thing they're doing is they're picking the things that they do the best. And Jennifer mentioned, you know, the award-winning work that they've done, and they're doing what they can to preserve those things.
This idea of there being a newspaper of record, that it seems like this is a kind of staid, old-fashioned concept that we have to redefine or rethink. It's something you've been writing about.
I think it's very much a declension narrative that we ever even had that. And you know, this could be a whole other show for another day, but I imagine there are audiences in where you live and where I live that would say that newspaper never covered my community because my community didn't look like the people in that newsroom. So, you know, aside from that, yes, I think that a lot of newspapers are coming to terms with the fact that they won't cover everything that happens, that they have to make choices. But I think that there are also some fascinating media ecosystems where Philly is a great example, where there's the, you know, the traditional newspaper that's trying to become digital. There's the public radio station, which in a lot of cases is getting beefed up with former newspaper reporters who are learning how to become yeah. radio reporters. Yeah. There's in Philly, there's Billy Penn, right, which is an online news source. There's nonprofits, there's for-profits. And so I think that the way that I like to think of it is, if newspapers once were, and I think it's arguable, the blanket that covered a community, they're now a patch in the quilt. And so for, I think, your audience, the thing to look for, if you care about local news and you want it to remain vibrant, I think the thing to look for is, where else is it happening and how can you support it? Mm-hmm. And how can you make sure that people know about it? And one of the easiest ways is, if you like something, share it.
Yeah.
You know, make sure that other people know that you're reading it or listening to it or watching it, and that it's out there.
Talk a little bit more about these partnerships, the ProPublica partnerships, for example. There's some damn good journalism being done in these when
it's
people
so exciting.
Get to 11.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things, so there are so many things in American newspapers that have sort of gone away or are much diminished, photography, copy editing, and investigative journalism. And so ProPublica is working with a handful of local newsrooms and essentially funding a position, but also that then that reporter gets to work with ProPublica's editor. So they're getting not just the position, but the editing chops. Report for America is currently putting reporters in newsrooms around the country. Their goal, I think, in the next 5 years is to get 1,000. They are they're platform agnostic, so they're working with all kinds of newsrooms, but they're trying to get the community and the news organization to pay for half. To raise and that money and pay for half of a person's job. I like to think of it as Peace Corps for news.
Right.
And to cover, you know, that person's not going to go and cover high school sports. They're going to cover critical issues that are no longer getting covered. So there's some really great partnerships happening And then, you know, I have a piece actually that I'm writing right now about six or seven weeklies and newspapers in Eastern Long Island that are from three different owners that are working together to cover the opioid crisis there. They know that they can't do that story by themselves. And even though they see each other as competition, they know that if they combine their forces, they can better serve their audience.
You've written about the fact that even though these kinds of layoffs that we've been talking about are sad and frustrating and all of those kinds of things, that they do tend to spur some innovation. So in that sense, do you feel hopeful that, I mean, you can't go much further down. And so I'm guessing you must feel hopeful for the potential for creativity these days.
I think the potential is there. I think that I'm hopeful about the people who are still there and who are fighting. And I think that the work that they do is essential to local communities. I do get discouraged, however, by the same thing happening over and over and over again. And the thing that I'm hopeful for, really, is when I see journalists starting to think about the business of what we do and to realize that it's not enough just to report the news. Now you need to understand the impact that it has and what you're bringing to the health of your news organization. Newsrooms have thought for a long time about a wall between business and the news. And I'm not speaking strictly about advertising. I heard someone in Ohio, a publisher of an online for-profit in Ohio, describe it as a fence, and you can look over it and understand what's happening on the other side. And I think that's a healthy and probably necessary way to proceed right now. Basically, if you want to be in the business, you have to care about the business.
That's Kristen Hare, reports on news for the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. We'll put a link to her reporting on our website, RadioWest.org. Kristen, thank you very much
for taking
the time. Thanks. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.